16 October 2012, time is 1:02 local. Continuing RRSG, who is?
Thanks, and welcome back for those of you that are here in Toronto for lunch. For those of you that are remote, welcome back as well. We're going to get going with an update on the WHOIS replacement protocol briefing from ICANN and IETF folks, Steve and Murray. I will turn things over to you, and thank you for coming by today to make this update.
Thank you, and thank you for giving us this opportunity. So recently, the IETF chartered a working group to work on a new protocol for internet registration data. So from the ICANN area, there are a couple of policy working groups, or not policy working groups, but a couple of activities that are related on this issue. So the most recent GNSO and ESSEC report on internationalized registration data, one of their recommendations is pointing out that the WHOIS protocol has not been internationalized, and therefore it will have challenges in supporting internationalized registration data going forward, and therefore calling the community to evaluate and to assess a replacement protocol for WHOIS. So that's one stream of work. The second stream of work is last year, ESSEC published SAC 51, WHOIS domain name terminology, which one of the recommendations ESSEC also asserts is for the community, the ICANN community, to evaluate and assess a replacement protocol. And there are similar streams of work indications in the WHOIS review team report.
Steve, do you have slides for what you're talking about? Because you need to display them using that laptop.
There will be.
Oh, okay. Shortly. All right. We just thought.
Yeah. So this is, you know, recently, you know, the IETF worked to for the replacement protocol. So we thought we want to provide the community an update and briefings on these issues so that to engage a dialogue. So sometimes the technical community and the policy community may need to engage dialogues on these earlier on. So this is one of those sessions where this could be possible. So Murray, who is the IETF working group chair on this, will give us a presentation, and after that we'll be happy to answer questions. I'm going to present on my computer. That's possible.
I'm just realizing the typo. Where is?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Murray Kucharavi. I'm one of the two co-chairs for the WHOIS working group at the IETF. We are chartered to do the work that you're talking about here. The need for a new protocol, as you might imagine, comes from the fact that WHOIS, which is from RFC 3912, has never been internationalized. There's no way to make an internationalized query, no standard way to make an internationalized query, or provide an internationalized answer, something that supports better than basic ASCII answers. Among the other problems, there's no data framework. Every service you ask, every WHOIS service you ask, can give you a different answer. Data can come in different orders. Dates can be formatted however the local site does it or in any manner, really. The same with phone numbers and other objects in the reply can be formatted or ordered in any way. And this might be fine for humans, but it's not especially useful for systems that need to get access to this information in a more automated way. Another important thing that's missing from WHOIS is that we do not have the ability to support the notion of differentiated access. All clients look the same, apart from the fact that their IP addresses are different. I can't tell if two clients coming from the same IP address are the same user, or one is a user, one is a program, one has privileges the other shouldn't have, or anything of that nature. It's therefore difficult to give what we call privileged access to information, and that doesn't mean that, it's not a reference to PII, it means that this client is different from that client in some way. It could be rate limiting, it could be the type of data that are returned to the queries. So we formed a working group inside the IATF in response to increasing demand for solutions to these problems. And among the things we're chartered to tackle are the standardization of a data framework. So if you're going to present a date, here's how you have to present it so that other so clients all know how to handle the reply. Deliver objects encapsulated in the framework over a RESTful service using HTTP. And those are basically some buzzwords for do it cheap and easy with readily available software already. We are keenly aware, and this has come up many times in our work, especially in the chartering process, that we already took a run at doing this with the CRISP working group some years ago that went absolutely nowhere after it was, I think, one major provider adopted it or took a run at adopting it. So, but we, although the technology has, for all intents and purposes, failed us, the requirements are largely the same. They haven't changed. So we are paying very close attention to wanting to tackle the problem in a way that is that manifests and appears rather than in a way that nobody can adopt or nobody will adopt. And keep it simple, yet support internationalized registration data is a key goal here. We also want this notion of the capability, not the requirement, of differential service based on authentication of the client. If I can tell that you are a specific kind of client, I want to give you a specific kind of information and perhaps give you more or less access to what I have. And as much as possible, we want to do this in a way that addresses the needs both of both names and number registries. The ICANN has many notions of a constituency. With the IATF looking at this problem, we really have two. We have the names, which are the RIRs, and we have the numbers, which are the RIRs, and we have the names, which is all the domain registries. And we really want as much as possible to produce a single protocol here that deviates as little as possible for the two major constituencies. So very briefly, why did we go with RESTful? Well, it uses HTTP, and there's ample code out there to produce HTTP clients and servers now, so that makes perfect sense to do it that way. Another important property of something that is RESTful is that it's stateless. Maintaining state is expensive, so try not to. The layering and cacheability, I won't go into the here, although I will say that they provide additional capabilities for enhanced services. But perhaps one of the most interesting things here is that an object that you want to ask about is represented by a URI. There's an example here for something at Aaron where you're asking about an object inside the Aaron database. And this means that a browser can pull that up, a curl client can pull that up, anything that is able to query an HTTP URI can get this information and do something interesting with it. That makes it available to a large client base right away. And we actually already have running code. Five of the six RIRs have put up prototypes of this concept. In fact, Aaron put theirs up a while ago and has been encouraging use of it to the point where they now get more queries for this than they do for conventional port 43 who is. So this kind of momentum is extremely encouraging that we're on the right track. CRISP never saw anything remotely like this as far as I can tell, although I must admit that CRISP predates my work at the IATF altogether. So the working group status we chartered in April of this year, there are five core documents we're working on. The basic protocol we're calling RDAP. RDAP over HTTP, a very simple introduction to doing this kind of work using HTTP. You format the query like a URI, as you saw on a previous slide. Replies will come, the current favorite is JSON. We thought about XML and moved instead in this direction. An entire document about security considerations, encrypting the data if necessary, identifying clients differently from each other, to whom you show which kinds of data. That's an informational document for people to build policy on. It is not us declaring any kind of policy whatsoever. And redirects. So if you ask Aaron about a network number that is owned by LACNIC, then Aaron will do the redirect. And so this is simply a document that explains how to do that. The last RFC in this list is scheduled to be done in terms of the working group at the end of December 2013. There are still the usual IETF approval procedures beyond that, but we expect to have wrapped up by then. And there's confidence in the working group that we can be done by then. For those interested in monitoring or even participating, which we would very much welcome, the next meeting is in November. The first full week of November is the next IETF meeting, and I believe WEIRDS is meeting on Monday. The URL you can see here, you can see the working group charter, the various drafts we're working on, and some I don't know, adjacent ones that have been offered that the working group isn't actually tackling yet. Contact information for the co-chairs or the area director if you're interested, and archives for and subscription access to the mailing list, which is completely open. And I think that's all I had. If there are questions for me or Steve, I'd be happy to tackle them.
Great. Thanks, guys. Questions? Is this something that folks are in the room? I know some of them are familiar with it, but I don't know if it's something that everyone is paying close attention to or not. Why are you looking at me? I always look at you. You're sitting right next to me. That's why. Yeah, okay. Thanks, guys. It's
Do you have a question?
Oh, yeah. I wonder if you can speak to how this would, if a thick versus thin WHOIS model, how that plays into the RESTful protocol and if the two are interconnected. Because obviously the registrars have the data in a thin model, but all, you know, we're kind of transitioning other than Common Net to more of a thick model. So is that something that's being discussed as well?
So the protocol will not affect either, you know, you can accommodate either thick or thin model. So there's nothing in the protocol that, you know, will not be able to accommodate one or the other. So, but depending on which model to choose, that's a policy question that to be discussed and reach consensus.
Right. So then in the current environment, this new WHOIS protocol, if we still have thin WHOIS for Common Net, would have a somewhat of a significant impact on registrars. Since we're already providing the WHOIS output, you know, we would have to change systems and adapt to the new protocol once this is adopted, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Thanks, guys.
I can just really quickly on
sure.
that. There, the focus of the working group is to enable any of the technical solutions you're talking about, either thick or thin, and any kind of policy that you want to deploy. We're trying very hard to stay out of those decisions and just let you guys sort that piece out. So if we've missed something like that, that's exactly the kind of feedback that we're interested in hearing. If you feel like the protocol is too heavyweight for thin, or the you know, if we've done something wrong in that regard, please do let us know before it gets too far.
Okay. Yeah, no, I think staying out of the thin versus thick WHOIS discussions, a good move. Kudos.
We want to stay out of as much as possible.
Yeah. Great. Well, again, thanks for coming by and giving the update. Appreciate it. Now I think we have the policy staff, although I'm looking, there's Marika. It's really dark in this room for those of you that aren't physically here, so, and I guess I'm getting older, so the two combined. Mood lighting, yeah, it's great. We're preparing for music night, although I noticed that, Adam, your boom mic is gone. What happened?
I don't know what happened. Something about they checked, you know, where I lived, and I'm actually in the suburbs, so I'm not a true Torontoite.
Nice.
Sorry, Torontonian.
Torontonian. Okay. Hi, Marika.
Yeah, you're ready
for
me?
You're ready to go? Yeah,
I'm ready to go. Hi, everyone. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Marika Konings. I'm a senior policy director with ICANN, supporting the GNSO and some of the policy development activities there. So I'll just be taking you through some of the activities that are going on in the GNSO. I selected three of those, but if you have questions on any of the other initiatives that are going on, I'm happy to try and answer those. Are my slides here, Tim? No, but here? Okay. If you want to put the Adobe up here, that's fine as well. Yes, I think it's this one. This is just loading. Maybe just in the meantime to mention that I think some of the initiatives I'll be talking about, several of you are participating in that, so you know, please feel free to speak up if you feel I'm missing some points or not saying the right things. So first of all is the inter-registrar transfer policy part C, and I think you already heard from compliance this morning that this still is a major area of where we get a lot of complaints. So this is an area where the GNSO has already been working on a while on this issue. The policy itself was adopted in 2004, and ever since then they identified a list of issues that needed further clarification or improvement, and as a result of that they split those up in a number of PDPs, basically labelled from A to E, and we're currently dealing with part C of that. So the Part C working group was asked to look at three specific issues. So the first, looking at a change of control or a change of registrant function. A second question related to whether there should be a time limit on forms of authorization. And third of all, should registries be required to use IANA IDs for registrars rather than using proprietary IDs? So I think last time in Prague, I think I spoke to you about the initial report that was published, which had a number of preliminary recommendations in there, but also a number of questions that the working group was looking for input on. And as a result of that, we got quite a couple of number of comments. Also, as a result of the workshop we held there, and several of you participated in that, and I think it was really helpful, the feedback we received there. So based on that, the working group went back and looked at all the comments received and continued its deliberations on some of the open items they had identified. And they managed to come to agreement on the recommendations, and they published their final report just prior to this meeting and submitted that to the GNSO Council for its consideration. So what are the recommendations in the report? Actually, the headings cut off slightly here on the board, but I see it there. So in relation to the first question on whether there should be a change of control or a change of registrant function, I think maybe to give a little bit of context there, I think the working group actually tried themselves to enact a change of registrant and did a little case study and realized that it actually was really, really difficult and worked different based on which registrar you would use, and these were really experienced people, not the average registrants for whom it might even be more complicated. And in addition to that, they actually went to meet with the CCNSO and came to the conclusion that actually all CCTLD operators have a change of registrant process, or have different terms for that. I think some use the term trade or but actually realizing that this is a very common process in the CCTLD context. So I think on the basis of that, and also looking at the issues the lacking of a process is currently creating, with the IRTP being used in certain instances as demonstrating a control of a name and actually changing domain names, they thought it would be a good idea to actually recommend the creation of a specific policy that would outline the rules for changing registrants. So their idea is that basically the IRTP would convert into an overarching transfer policy, with one leg being the rules for changing registrars and the other part being the rules for changing registrants. So here just a few points, but if you're really interested in the details of that policy, because they put quite a lot of work in outlining the different steps and also providing a lot of information on the different case studies or different scenarios you would have in this situation, I would really like to refer you to the report. But just very briefly, basically there would be a requirement for both the prior and the new registrant to authorize the change. There is a possibility, or it's foreseen there, that it's possible to allow for pre-approval, something that the aftermarket participants were very keen about. Basically, it's not possible to have a change of registrant at the same time as a change of registrar. And just to clarify, it means that it cannot be done simultaneously. It doesn't mean that you cannot do it 1 second after each other or in a very short time frame, but it's just it would not be possible to commingle the two in one procedure. And also there's a recommendation that following a change of registrant, the domain name is locked for 60 days for security purposes, but there is the possibility to for the registrant to ask for an opt-out of that lock. So I'm looking... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I got a question on that locking period. Would a change of registrant that's been completed also prevent a change of registrar afterwards? Like, would a domain that's just been where the registrant has been changed be locked from a transfer, a registrar transfer?
Yes, I think the idea is that you cannot transfer registrars immediately after a change of registrant. I think the whole idea is to avoid, you know, situations where there's hijacking. So the default would be a 60-day lock, but there's the option to lock to opt out of that. And I think also you'll see that there's one of the recommendations that's still in the process of implementation from IRTP Part B that provides for the unlocking of a domain name upon the request of a registrant within 5 business days. So the default would be the 60-day lock, but there are mechanisms to unlock and still engage in the transfer. But it's mainly... for security purposes, I think that the lock was it has been recommended.
Okay.
Just to expand on that, and John, I think whatever you're reading must be exciting because I'm surprised you're not all over this. So could you walk through how this would work in the sale of a domain name where the buyer is going to use a different registrar than the seller, which, by the way, is, you know, the which is something that happens thousands and thousands of times every day, you know, relative to the very rare hijacking that doesn't get rectified in the normal system.
Right, and in that case, and then looking around if there are any of the aftermarket participants in the working group, I think in that case they would ask for the opt-out because they do want to consciously, immediately transfer a domain name after the change of registrant to another registrar. So in that case, they request the opt-out so they can make that change.
John, have you looked at that? Like, have you seen whether that opt-out is going to, you know, make the secondary market people happy?
I haven't looked at it in detail. My understanding is it would, but no one's gotten excited about it yet.
Yeah. Hold on, guys. First, can you make sure that you say your names because the remote folks don't know who's speaking? And then, yeah, James, you had a point. Go ahead.
Yeah, so there's... As you might imagine, this was a topic that was discussed fairly extensively, and we worked very closely with our representatives from SATO and from Name Media because I think that they wanted to preserve the fluidity of what you're talking about for the transactions. And so what we came up with was, as this compromise, and I admit it's complicated, but is the idea that you can, at the time of sale, get your registrant to opt out of this lock. If they don't and they forget and they trigger the lock, you have to remove it. You know, because of IRTPB says once you're asked to remove the lock, you remove the lock. So you've got the front end opt out, you've got the back end requirement to remove, and then you know, what we're trying to avoid here, particularly in thin registries. Sorry, this is James Bladel. I just completely missed Matt's instructions. What we're trying to avoid, and we did all kind of look at this particular scenario. So it is hijacking, Elliot, but it is something else, which is that in thin registries, when a domain name shows up at the doorstep of a new registrar with a new contact, there is really no way of knowing, you know, where it came from and who those people are. So, and this gets even more complicated in the new RAA, but let's just set that aside. So this is kind of what we came up with as a bridge, is this: you can opt out at the beginning, you can remove it at the end, but, you know, if it's left in as a component transaction, there is this lock.
And is that opt out, you know, one of the problems with the 60-day lock is that the language, well, I don't think the language was ambiguous, but it was interpreted as ambiguous by some. And, you know, is that opt out very prescriptive? In other words, you know, is there no wiggle room on the part of the registrar around that opt out?
That's the intent. There is no final language yet because this is going to, and Marika is going to cover this, is there's a follow-up team. We recognize the importance that not just punting these issues over to staff and letting them fill in those blanks, especially blanks like that. So the members of the working group, and I'm sure that our aftermarket reps will be among them, will help craft that language, and I think that's the intent that we would try to preserve, yeah. We want it both ways. That's why it's complicated.
Yeah, thanks, James. Marika, do you mind if Michele's got an additional comment as well? Keep going. Yeah, Michele.
Now, just speaking to Elliot's point, which I think is, you know, it's important. I mean, Elliot, when this goes through the implementation phase, and, you know, it's down to wording that carefully, it would be great to have the input from people like yourself, because, you know, the last thing we want is something coming out the far end that's going to be impossible to put into action in the real world.
So could I... Mike Zupke, ICANN staff. So Tim Cole and I will be, you know, probably kind of leading the charge here on implementation when it comes to that. And, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about is, you know, how do registrars expect to see this work? In particular, can you go back a slide, Marika? How should this process work? Our concern is that, you know, we're not registrars. We don't know how you've set up your systems, and so we really do want to get input from you on that. And I don't know how many people are going to volunteer for the IRT, but I feel like this is definitely a place where you want to be involved in giving your input, so that we don't, you know, create a system that you can't or don't want to use.
Thanks, Mike. Good discussion, Marika.
Yeah, I can definitely, and really, you know, it's really helpful to receive that input, and very grateful as well to the working group members to help, you know, defend the recommendations that the working group has come up with. And I think, as many have said, it's, you know, this is compromise language, and I think as part of the implementation, we'll see as well that there probably will be a need as well to build in that you know, education and outreach to registrars to really explain the whole, you know, new structure, and you know, that will definitely be an effort that will require some time and dedication. So looking at the next recommendation, charter question B, related to the FOAs, so the recommendation there from the working group is that the FOA should not be valid for longer than 60 days. So basically, following that expiration, the registrar must reauthorize the transfer request by getting a new FOA. There is, again, here a possibility for automatic renewal. Again, I think as a concession to the aftermarket to allow for, you know, situations where a domain name is on sale, and you know, you don't want to constantly have to ask a registrant for a new FOA. So in addition, the recommendation also specified that the FOA also automatically expires if there is a change of registrant, or if the domain name expires, or if the transfer is executed, or if there is a dispute filed for the domain name. So in those cases, there's an automatic expiration. And there is a recommendation that the next IRTP PDP should actually look at the question of whether EPP auth info codes actually have eliminated the need for FOAs, and whether these are still necessary. So I think this is an issue you might see coming up in the next PDP. So I said before, this report has now been submitted to the GNSO Council for its consideration. They have it on the agenda for their session on Wednesday. I don't know at this stage whether there will already be a vote on it or whether there will be a request for deferral if some groups might need more time to actually review the recommendations. We also have a workshop scheduled tomorrow to provide the community an update on what is in this report from 8:30 to 10. So if you have more questions or want to, you know, hear this again, you're welcome to come then. Following the GNSO Council, assuming that they adopt the recommendations, and just for the record, the recommendations in the report did have the unanimous consensus of the working group members, so there was no opposition. Everyone agreed with the recommendations. They would then go out for a public comment before the board would consider those. And once the board has adopted them, then they move into implementation. And as some people have already referred to, there's also a recommendation by the working group to form an implementation review team consisting of working group members that would work with staff on the implementation of these recommendations. And basically, based on that work they would be doing, there would also be a proposed implementation plan that then eventually is also put out for public comment, so that the broader community can also provide input on that. And I think that's it for the IRGP. See, I have more topics, but I don't know if there are other questions on this one.
Yep. No, thanks, Marika. I think there's a question online, but I also just want to give a shout-out to you for the graphics in the slide deck. Very, very good use of stock photos. Kudos. Volker's got a question online, and then I don't know if there's additional questions in the room or not. Volker.
Yes, there's a question, or more like a statement, from Bob Connolly regarding what James is saying. It's often necessary to update the email contents of the admin contact prior to a transfer. If it's not updated, the FOA will not reach the admin contact. Locking the domain name for this reason is a real problem.
Yep, thanks. And again, just as, I don't know if it was James or Michaeli said, several of us were active in IRTP Part C, and when we get to that implementation team, would definitely encourage additional folks to participate, because obviously this is a pretty big policy change. It'll have a significant impact on us from an operational standpoint. Any other IRTP stuff? If not, Mariko, we can move on to the next. Oh, sorry, James, go ahead, before you take a bite of your apple.
Yeah, I can do it right in the microphone. Just that there is going to be, you mentioned IRTPD and the consolidation. Okay, sorry. So there's another IRTP, the last, actually there were two. We recommended to the council that they be combined into one, IRTPD. D as in done, with IRTP working groups. So, you know, we'd encourage registrar participation on that upcoming working group, and we'll probably see a call for volunteers between now and Beijing.
Yeah, and this is Rick on that point. Indeed, the adoption of the recommendations, in addition to that, there's the initiation of our request for an issue report on the last, hopefully last, PDP on this topic at least. And I think in addition to the question on, you know, whether EPP auth info codes have overtaken the need for FOAs, I think a lot of the other questions relate to the transfer dispute resolution policy and questions surrounding that. And I think one other question relating to whether there should be penalties in case of violations of the IRTP. So I think that's a package for the last one. And as James said, you know, would produce an issue report, and then following that, the PDP would get initiated and a working group is formed. So if you're interested in that topic, there's another opportunity to participate in the working group. So the next one I wanted to briefly mention is the Thick Who Is policy development process that's currently ongoing. You already had a bit of discussion on Who Is just before this, and thought it might be worth mentioning. And I think you're all familiar with you know, the difference between the thick and thin. But I think here, as part of discussions, we actually had an IRTP, and I think, as was just mentioned before as well, that there would be real advantages in having thick OIs from certain perspectives. But there's also other elements that would need to be considered, you know, in determining whether there should be a requirement for requiring thick OIs for all GTLDs. So on the basis of that, the GNSO Council initiated a policy development process on this topic. The next step in that process was to form a drafting team that would develop the charter for the working group. And that drafting team has been working pretty hard to get that charter ready for Toronto. And it's also on the agenda for the GNSO Council to consider at its meeting on Wednesday. So basically, as the charter is currently framed, basically the objective of the working group would be to provide the GNSO Council with a policy or recommendation regarding the use of Thick Who Is by all registries, both existing and future. And the charter also outlines the different topics the working group would need to consider in order to be able to make that determination. So they'll be asked to look at response consistency, stability issues, accessibility, what impact would there be on data and privacy protection, potential cost implications, synchronization and migration, authoritativeness, competition and registry services, existing WHOIS applications, data escrow, and also registrar port 43 WHOIS requirements. So basically the working group would be asked to look at each of these elements and basically weigh, you know, the pros and cons of requiring Thick Who Is, and based on hopefully the overall evaluation, come to a recommendation on whether or not to require Thick Who Is. In addition, the charter also outlines that, you know, should the working group come to consensus on requiring Thick Who Is, it should also look at another number of issues, or at least provide guidance to the council, and as well as part of implementation on issues such as costs, guidelines on how to conduct the actual transition, and consider whether there should be any special provisions or exceptions. And the charter also specifies that the working group should look at some of the other initiatives that are going on as they may relate to Thick Who Is, such as registrar separation discussions, REA negotiations, the Who Is studies, the 2004 transition of .org from thin to thick, the work that's being done on internationalization, as you heard before, although I think they pointed out that model would accommodate for either way. and as well the recommendations of the WHOIS review team. So as I said, the council is expected to consider adoption of the charter at this meeting. Again, there might be a deferral, which would mean it would go to the next council meeting, but as soon as the charter is adopted, a call for volunteers will go out to form the working group, and just like to encourage you all, if you have an interest in this topic, to please join and participate in the working group. I don't know if there are any questions on this topic.
Anyone?
Moving on. To the next. So another policy development process that's currently ongoing, and I think it was already touched upon this morning as well, is in relation to the locking of a domain name subject to UDRP proceedings. So basically this comes out from an issue report that was requested on an overall review of the UDRP, but the council decided that to leave that for a later stage, but instead just focus on this very specific issue of the locking of a domain name subject to UDRP proceedings. I think as many as you know, currently there's no requirement to lock domain names in between the filing of a complaint and the commencement. The UDRP just refers to status quo. There's no definition of what status quo means, which has resulted in different interpretations and also confusion, I think, among registrars, but also complainants and UDRP providers. So the working group is basically asked to respond to a host of questions, which I think basically come down to when and how to lock. So they're basically looking at, because I think there is general agreement that status quo doesn't mean that it needs to be locked down and no changes can be made, but the question is really when should that happen, at what stage? Is that at commencement? Is that at the stage of verification? Should there be a new step built in at which locking is requested? In what time frame, once the information is received by the registrar, how quickly does a lock need to be applied? And I think one of the more challenging questions is going to be what is actually locked, what changes are permitted, and I think there the key question is there as well in relation to privacy and proxy. Should the real registrant be revealed? Should any changes be allowed, or should it, at the time of locking, that's what is there, that's how it will stay? So those are some of the questions that the working group is asked to look at. So at the starting point, the working group was asked to actually gather information and get input from the different parties on really trying to understand what the issues are and what current practices are. So they conducted a survey amongst registrars and as well as UDRP providers, and we actually got a really good response from the registrar community, and I want to thank you all for that, on the basis of which they developed a little summary that gave a bit of an insight on the current practices, and I think it did paint the picture that indeed, there's no consistency. Some lock upon notification, some lock upon verification. So I think it provided the working group with some useful insights on what is currently going on. In addition, they also opened a public comment forum, and they reached out to the different GNSO stakeholder groups and constituencies, as well as the different supporting organizations and advisory committees, to ask them for input that might help inform their deliberations. So they've now actually started looking at the comments received and going through them and trying to slowly come to agreement or initial recommendations on these different questions that they've been tasked with. So that's the work that is ongoing, and I think they've set themselves as a goal to publish their initial report by December. So if you're interested in this topic, the working group is having a meeting later this week on Thursday from 9 to 10:30. I think the intention is to make that really interactive. We've tasked a number of working group members to defend certain propositions with the idea of trying as well to get feedback from attendees, whether either propositions are supported or what the challenges might be, which we then hope will inform the working group with directions to take on these issues. Because I think as we've seen as well in the results of the survey and as well putting together the program for the workshop, it looks like there are a limited number of answers that the working group will be looking at, when do you lock and how do you lock. So it's the number of options and trying to come to a consensus on what the appropriate way would be to dealing with those. And I think that's all I had for today. So I don't know if there are any questions or...
Great. Thanks, Marika. I know that Michaeli is actually chairing the
locking a domain subject to a UDRP, and John, Volker, Luke, I think some others are involved as well. So I encourage you guys to attend that session tomorrow, as well as the IRT people. Oh, sorry, Thursday, as well as the IRTP one. Any additional questions for Marika on the three areas that she covered today, or anything else? Excellent. Thanks, Marika. You've left us all speechless. Yeah, well done. That's actually tough for this group.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. And as I said, you know, we're always ready and available if there are questions or if people want to get involved but feel a bit overwhelmed with all the information that we might provide here. You know, feel free to reach out to us, and we'll do our best to help you catch up.
Great. Thanks. So we're about 15 minutes, I think, ahead of time. Our board meeting with the board starts in their room in about 30 minutes, so we'll get an extra 15 minutes to either walk really leisurely down to their room or just take a 15-minute break. We're in the Metro East, which is across the way on this level or downstairs? Straight across the Sky Bridge. Oh, on the, yeah. Where the RAA session was yesterday. So we start that at 2. Just
same level as the exhibition area.
Yes, right next to the exhibition area. So we'll do that starting in just about 30 minutes. So we'll see everyone over in the board meeting room in 30. Thanks.
Before everybody goes, can I just get a quick announcement? Just an announcement. The budget was approved. Thank you for everybody for your feedback. I thought it went really, really well, and we got all the requested changes into the new version that was adopted, and invoices will be going out soon, so watch for those. Thanks.
That was 5 to 7 seconds. Well done. Thanks, James.